Hey, all, it's a Monday night, and we're talking movies. I'm your host, Phil, and I'm with the regular guys, Andy, right here.
Hello, this is Andy.
And Greg.
Hello, this is Greg.
And tonight, we're going to be focusing on Steven Soderbergh, who has a new film called Side Effects. And it's, to put it very loosely, a thriller that also tackles some social issues based in the pharmaceutical world and the psychiatric world. And I think the reason I was interested in seeing Side Effects was really because of Soderbergh's attachment to the project. I know I've seen almost every one of his films since Living in Los Angeles in the theater, and he has quite an extensive catalog in the last 10 years. And the only one I haven't seen in the theater going down the list is The Good German. But recently, Soderbergh in the last couple of years has done, well, with Side Effects, and he did Magic Mike, Haywire, Contagion, The Informant, The Girlfriend Experience, and Shay in the last 5 years. So let's start there. What do you guys think about when Soderbergh comes to mind?
I think of an experimenter. I think he's one of the most, he tries a lot of different things, and that's probably the thing I like and admire the most about him.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first thing that instantly comes to mind is Ocean's 11, because I still come back to it as one of my sort of, you know, contemporary favorite movies. And it's, I think it even represents like an odd thing about the guy in that it's really unlike any of his other movies. Like you don't, it might be the one that is maybe besides the cast, like even a little tough to, at least from this later period, know that it's like a Soderbergh movie or, you know, I'm not sure if that gets at it that well, but you know, but then I would say the other thing I like about the guy is I like his kind of philosophy of filmmaking, you know, even if I don't like his movies, I really like reading about how he makes them, reading about what he says about, you know, his way he tackles projects. Those are the kind of things that come to mind.
Yeah. It's... I'm going to need, I'm a little tired.
Well, did you, did this being like, you know, his last movie in the theater have any different resonance, or was it just still like you would have seen this, you know, because it was a Soderbergh movie anyways?
For his last one being Magic Mike, I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And it stood out as like a bit of a surprise because some of his films, I feel, are like, especially lately, Greg brought up, like, the experimental.
Cold.
Yeah. And that they're very interesting to be, like, taking as part of his collective body. But I don't know if anyone would, like, Bubble, which is his most experimental and was designed to be experimental.
Well, he did Schizopolis.
And he did, in the previous decade.
What's the one that he did on like a little tiny camera?
The Girlfriend Experience.
No, even before that, way back when those cameras,
Full Frontal.
That was right after Ocean's 11.
Right.
Yeah. And big cast.
I mean, Good German is really experimental. He shot it like the way they shot old Mike, like studio movies, right?
Right. Yeah.
Didn't he, you know?
They shot as much as they could, rear projection. I mean, it's a pretty unusual movie.
So, do you guys go to, like, how many of, when he has a new movie in the theater, do you go see it in the theater?
I've seen, that you listed them, I've seen most of them in the theater, but I go through phases. So, actually, the two movies that I didn't see in the theater were Che and The Girlfriend Experience, but...
The Girlfriend Experience, I think, was the first one to be, like, I think it was released directly to on demand.
I remember watching that on demand.
It was one of those,
But I've gone in and out with Soderbergh. I mean, you know, as probably everybody has in a weird way, like because he goes and actually his movies are interesting because some of them I don't think age very well. And others I didn't like that much, but I continue to think about them. Like The Informant's a good example of a movie that when I first saw it, I really did not like it. I found it like really tedious. And I was like, okay, I don't know about this guy anymore kind of thing. I mean, I you know, I still admire his work, but you know what I mean? Like when the filmmaker kind of, you know, he's off in his own world kind of thing. But I actually still talk about The Informant and I reference it. And it actually oddly became like one of the, I think what Phil is getting at is talking about how Soderbergh is making these movies that are very relevant to the contemporary world. Cause The Informant was made like before like the Bernie Madoff and all these like real world examples of this like bizarro type of,
I mean, I'm laughing just thinking of parts of the movie because it does stick.
I think we all saw it together.
Yeah, we saw it. And the performance certainly sticks in your head for a long time afterwards versus...
But it's a kind of frustrating movie.
Right. Yes. I remember, as soon as it's mentioned, I remember the emotional response I had throughout the movie. There was some parts where I'm like, I can't stand another minute of this movie. I'm going to walk out. And then 5 minutes later, I'd be like, I'm actually liking this guy and tolerating it. And then it would shift. It was a very... like notable experience where I still don't know if I like the movie or not, but I've thought about it enough where I must have gotten a lot out of it.
Yeah.
And
well, that, you know, I don't know. It's a weird thing. Cause I sometimes I feel like maybe this is might sound a little weird, but I feel a little bit guilt. This is kind of weird, but how, you know, I kind of, you know, you admire somebody as a filmmaker, and then do you put upon relevance to anything they do afterwards, regardless of what, you know what I'm saying? Like you give people benefit of the doubt, kind of thing. Like you watch Haywire, you watch Haywire, for instance, and that I thought was a pretty just like haphazard movie kind of thing, and then I'm like, well, okay, should I? So because Soderbergh made it, therefore it's something, you know, to be held in esteem kind of thing. I mean,
I don't know if every movie needs to be held in esteem, but for Soderbergh, I feel there's like an intelligence behind it that he's made enough movies that have a real thought and intelligence behind it. And there's a reason he's making it that I think he's earned. So then I do go into and watch Haywire with a different eye than simply, if Haywire was another, it was sort of a spy movie, but with a martial arts.
Yeah. Well, I guess
take on it. Watching it with a different eye, I guess, because I'm seeing it, how it works. Why he was attracted to it.
But I just wonder then if we're maybe like on the balance, putting too much balance on the individual making the movie versus maybe the ideas and the story and, you know, the things that are separate from the filmmaker, I guess.
Well, I mean, I still think you do, you know, maybe more than we admit are able to separate, well, did you like, you know, the movie or... You know, and I would say, I haven't liked all the guy. I don't come out liking all of his, you know, kind of recent movies, but I'm typically glad I saw them because I do see like his taste and an approach that is very different. For instance, I liked Haywire, and I think a lot of it had to do with it just felt like a bit of a fresh, even slightly fresh perspective on this, you know, spy action genre, and that he saw something in Gina Carano that was interesting, and I kind of saw that,
and that
as
was
well.
Enough. That was kind of enough.
Well, that was enough to get me through the movie. You know, there's been other ones that have been, you know, much bigger struggle. You know, I would say The Good German. I mean, it's not like I'm going to tell anybody to go see The Good German.
I like The Good German.
Or like The Girlfriend Experience was kind of interesting, but, you know, whereas like Haywire, and I mean, Magic Mike was like my favorite film of last year. So it's, and surprisingly so. So I think it was, and even had a lot of things that people have sort of piled on of Soderbergh, that his tendencies of kind of cold and not really emotional, or, you know, I found Magic Mike to be really the opposite, and like a lot of fun and, you know, kind of with a lot of heart for the characters. And so that's what I was able to get more into, because I do think his movie, certainly, you know, Side Effects, which we'll get into more, had some of those tendencies that people typically associate with this last 5 or 10 years. I think it's a pretty high example of them, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, you bringing up the term cold is an interesting one, because certainly we can lead into Side Effects with that. I found Side Effects to be a really good anchoring point for his last several movies, where all of a sudden I started seeing them all as like more like the whole rather than the sum of its parts. I did see it as like a companion piece with The Informant, and then I've looked at his other.
Well, I think
movies.
Stylistically, Haywire, it's like a really direct.
Beat. Stylistically, right? I was thinking more of the themes he's getting in modern society and his take on people.
And it's written by the same guy.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Contagion.
Which one?
Side Effects.
Yeah,
is written by. I'm sorry.
The guy who wrote The Informant.
Oh, true.
And he also wrote Contagion, I believe.
Right. And those...
The Informant was based on a book, too. Mm-hmm. You know, versus I think the other two are original.
Yeah.
Contagion and Side Effect.
But it is kind of... I felt like it did have the feel of Contagion also, now that I think about
it. No,
visually,
I think so.
Like,
yeah.
You know.
And maybe even more so with, like, a little bit of, like, a serving of social issue-ness, but not really... But couched in kind of a
but
a
so
genre.
Is Contagion in a way, right?
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that they both are. It's very, like, you know, like I see those more than The Informant, which was a little bit of a like almost comedy bonkers.
Right, and kind of like a investigation type of thing,
or
and character
piece,
study. Yeah, and like, I mean, although there is an investigative,
super heavy
there's an investigative,
in
there's
that weird, you know. Like, Contagion is much more of a little bit of realism,
mm-hmm.
but you know, stylistic realism than The Informant, I guess.
But, yeah, I mean, I wasn't even thinking so much about the themes, but I was actually thinking in, like, the way there's sort of, like, a sharp visual quality to both of them. And I talked about it with Phil yesterday a little bit. You talked about, like, the editing. I forgot what word you used for the editing, but there's sort of – I just feel like this sort of – like, I don't know, like sharp visual quality to both of those. And I can't really quite put my finger on why that exists. Maybe it's just the camera's like still a lot of the time and the edits are sharp. I don't know. It felt sharp.
With Soderbergh, he's shooting his own movies too now and editing quite a few of it. I mean, he edited and shot this. He edited and shot Magic Mike. And
I
then
think he's edited and shot everything but the Ocean's movies from the recent past.
Right. I'm not sure if he edited Haywire or Contagion.
I'm almost positive he did.
Yeah, maybe they might not have the credits,
but
I'm sure.
But maybe not. You know, because he goes by Mary and Bernard.
Right. That stood out watching Side Effects in the opening.
Seeing all of his
students. Mary and Bernard, and I'm like, I didn't realize that was his pseudonym for editing.
And Peter Andrews.
Yeah, that always pops out now.
No, yeah, I mean, there's nobody else that does it on that scale.
I mean, it's... Because then I'm starting to...
I guess Robert Rodriguez is known as kind of doing it, but he's a much different, you know, kind of filmmaker. But, I mean, a large scale.
Because we always talk about, like, an auteur and these writer-directors, but... Soderbergh doing the directing, the DPing, and the editing, and he does write. I think that's why they have.
Well, to me, it's still not the same, you know, because I still think the writing, the script is such a huge... I still think there's a difference. And just because... I mean, yes, editing is huge. Editors are, you know, a big collaborator. But it is, like, still the director, you know, from a writer-director, typically is going in with that, you know, fulfilling that vision, I suppose. But, yeah, you know, it's certainly worth a debate.
Because I do think it might not be... Yeah, it's an interesting one because you can... He's very diverse in his material now, but they have a Soderbergh stamp on it more than just him as directing. I think that, like, you're talking about the shots and like, the editing patterns and him having a direct touch on that, especially, I mean, him shooting his movies now.
Well, I think these last four or five have a really specific, even jumping between different kind of movies with Haywire, Magic Mike, Contagion, The Girlfriend Experience, and even Bubble to a degree, like are of a very different take on like the contemporary realist, you know, kind of viewpoint versus the like documentary handheld that would almost be the first thing people would think of for that like style of movie, I think.
Yeah, I was trying to classify, because I feel Soderbergh definitely has, like, a visual style, but I've never heard anyone, like, quite describe what that visual style is, because his shots and the way he shoots a scene, I find to be, like, very unto him. Like, I can tell more from watching the movie, like, this is a Soderbergh movie versus, like, the material. You know, like, you couldn't tell me, like, you wouldn't be able to describe Side Effects to me, and I'd be like, oh, I'm sure Soderbergh must have directed that.
Well, even like if you heard movie, a log line of a Tarantino log line, you're like, oh, that's a Tarantino movie or somebody ripping off a Tarantino movie.
Right.
But with Soderbergh, I mean, you could see a bunch of the Magic Mike movie.
Yeah,
a bunch of people could have made a version of that movie.
About the movies like that he sort of notoriously didn't get made, Moneyball.
Uh huh.
And then there was the sci-fi one, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Those were supposed to be pretty big movies, and I think there maybe was even one more that. You know, dropping out. That's like, wow, you throw those in there, it's really varied.
Yeah.
I brought up Moneyball being, man, that's one movie I would have really liked to have seen Soderbergh's take along with Bennett Miller's. Like, make the movie twice. It would have been so different. Not saying that Bennett Miller's version shouldn't have gotten made.
His version might have been, like, the better version.
Yeah,
but,
that's one movie that I do think more than just like cinephiles could have you know enjoyed.
I still think that's an I said this the other year to somebody that I think a movie studio should do this as sort of an experiment. But then I'm like, well, maybe that's only like a cinephile geek thing because people would be like, well, why regular people?
Yeah,
but
I just want to see the best version.
But wouldn't it be such like an interesting grand experiment to actually do it?
But here's a, you know, I guess, you know, neither version is supposed to be that great. So maybe it wasn't. But like the prequel to The Exorcist was essentially there's two different versions. There's a version that came out in theaters that Rennie Harlan.
Paul Schrader.
Yeah, Paul Schrader originally shot it, and then the movie was like 75% reshot by Rennie Harlan. But then years later, the Paul Schrader version has come out on DVD.
Interesting.
But,
that's kind of.
Well, I was, you know, I had a thought about when I was trailing like this sort of like present Soderbergh style back to like. You know, his past five movies or so. And then I think also, though, you know, maybe the first one that really gets at where he's at now was Ocean's 12. And it's kind of a really interesting, like, style, and even just sort of a little bit cinema history of you have this enormous hit in Ocean's 11. And then for the sequel, I mean, it's almost like a complete 180 in the style of filmmaking. I mean, it's such a... it's something like I didn't like Ocean's 12.
Yeah, I remember.
So but like,
I like. I mean, I think my brain's like blocked out Ocean's 12.
I mean, it is such a huge difference. Like, if you put the movies side by side, they don't really relate stylistically. Like, Ocean's 11 is.
Who is the 12th? Who do they add in Ocean's 12? Oh, is that Catherine Zeta-Jones?
Oh, no.
Okay, yeah, now I do remember that movie. Yeah, yeah,
it's running around a lot. I mean,
remember, yeah, we did not like that movie. Yeah, but it's one of those that, if it's on TV, I was able to watch it over and over again. It's Ocean's 13 that's unwatchable.
I liked Ocean's 13. I've watched Ocean's 13 a couple times, so I think I enjoyed the return. He sort of found a middle ground between 12 and 11, the style for Ocean's 13, and I liked it. But Ocean's 12 to me was one of the most experimental big budget movies, you know, maybe of our time, and such a weird one for, like, again, I can't think of another sequel that takes just a totally different, even visual look to it. Like, it just doesn't really exist in.
Do you think he was? I'm trying because I don't picture Soderbergh as a guy interested in redoing.
Right.
It. So then he went. Do you think too far then?
Yeah,
and that's why 12 isn't.
Well, I think it was. You know, I kind of liked rewatch 12 just partly because I read a quote. You know, in the recent stuff that's come out with Side Effects, like a film writer talking about Ocean's 12, like. The plot of Ocean's 12 is also the experience, a little bit, of Soderbergh making a sequel to a great film of these guys having to top their last incredible robbery in, like, what that is from just a narrative theme. And I don't remember that theme. I don't, you know, it wasn't that obvious to me, but I'm interested if, like, that was an actual narrative theme in it or if it's just this critic kind of throwing it out there. But I think it does get at, like, who the guy is as a filmmaker, that he would, you know, instill that into the movie to a degree.
Well, no, that, you know, you mean competing with yourself, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I heard Apatow he was talking about this same idea in an interview, talking about how he was like, yeah, it's pretty good chance I'm never going to make anything as good as Freaks and Geeks.
Oh,
and he's like, but what are you going to do? It was for This Is 40.
Did he know that when he did Freaks and Geeks, it was what he wanted to do? Like, that's as good as he could do it? Or is it only because of time passing and the critical response?
I don't know that.
I'm always curious
I don't know that. And I wouldn't necessarily, even if it time passing doesn't only have to do with critical response.
Oh, no,
I think he felt like they were doing, tapping into something special as they were doing it.
Yeah.
I do think he was saying that. But I think it's an interesting concept, this idea of, like, you know, yeah, I mean, sort of competing with your past work. And, I mean, I read a thing about Soderbergh, you know, because he's famous for, you know, saying he's going to make one more movie or something after this. He's doing his last five movies.
Well, he shot it, but it's coming out on HBO, so this is his last.
This is his last theatrical
release. Yeah, this is his last theatrical release. But I remember him saying retirement, I feel like, 5 movies ago. And then
he had them all
in the pipeline.
Well,
retiring.
And he said for it to actually happen that he had to say it that long ago so that people would stop, you know, sort of counting on him. And, you know, his collaborators would, you know, he wanted to give them time and people to, like, you know, because these things take so long for, like, the ingest of new projects for him to kind of, like, because if the scripts had kept coming to him,
he might have got excited or something again.
A little bit. So, you know.
I read something that he said he was retiring. And the only way he would come back is if it was as a completely different filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's an I thought that was a very interesting idea.
Well, he's left the door open a lot for TV. Like, he talks about TV a lot. And so, I think we'll probably see something before too long on TV. But who knows, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, I think that's why I'm, like, interested in him. Yeah, it's his sort of, like, creative evolution and, you know, how he approaches the process or whatever. I mean, you were saying earlier though that you tie. I think I have blocked out Ocean's 12. I mean, I'm not quite sure I see the sort of trajectory of. I definitely see a commonality with the Contagion. These last five movies or so,
like
stylistically, directorially. However, I actually The Informant felt a little bit different, and I don't know, Che. I only watched the first half.
I only watched the first one. No, The Informant is different. I would say, Ocean's 12 is similar in sort of camera style and lighting a lot to these, because I would say Ocean's 12 feels, you know, the most digital to me. Of the way he's shooting the movies. And The Informant, I mean, I can't really remember the style that well, but it didn't strike me
the way these other ones did.
And so these other ones do feel like he's, you know, pushing a certain style.
If anything, Bubble seems like an early experimentation with what and ultimately then it needed to became. Adjust it. Yeah. But Bubble is seems like in the vein, but not ultimately what ended up. The visual style of these last two. And even Magic Mike Magic Mike makes sense.
It's pretty close.
It's pretty, yeah. But I think what you were talking about earlier, sort of the emotion, there was something about Magic Mike that felt a little different, but that just might have to do more with performance. And
I'm wondering where sort of the technological innovations of digital filmmaking, how if you guys think that that's affected his style, or you associate that now with
that style. Well, I think it's affected his style a lot, but you know, I don't know whether it was because he wanted to change his style and then, you know, found a way to do it, but certainly the movies that he's kind of really shot digitally do have a much different feel. I mean, it's from, you know, Full Frontal was maybe the first one. I don't know if Solaris was, you know, digital or not. And then Ocean's 12 onward, you know, Ocean's 12, Bubble, Ocean's 13 even, you know, and Che certainly, like those are kind of the early ones that you would think he was straddling a little bit, but they still are very digital to me.
Because Traffic has a look now that's been like ripped off for so many years that you can rewatch Traffic and it's like, oh, like people might even say like it's dated.
I think Traffic is very dated because I recently rewatched
look
it.
Or
well, the everything because here's like, I mean, like the what it was exploring, like just topically, has been now looked at and talked about so much since then. That it feels like to me, even if you just like The Wire, looking at The Wire as like an examination of the drug trade is much more sophisticated than Traffic. And Traffic at the time was like, here's the nitty gritty inside look at like the real life drug trade. But it sort of pales, I think, in comparison to what's been done afterwards. But visually, what you're saying too, absolutely. Like the sort of style, has been copied for sure.
But do you think the technology, the digital cameras, and allowing him to shoot quicker, like he would have shot if he had choice, he would have shot Traffic digitally, and it was
definitely
now
just from because I think the style. I do think there's a tie into the style of Traffic, the way. You know, that is a little similar to the more digital stuff, like after Oceans. Like, Ocean's 11 is a very different style, but Ocean's 12, like, has something similar to Traffic with, like, the really blown-out windows and, like, lighting scenes with a really specific, like, color temperature, whether it's, like, a really cool blue or orange or, you know, yellow. Like, that stuff that he really pushed.
Does he do that in Ocean's 12, where he's changing sort of filters and all that stuff?
I feel it's very high contrast.
It's not as much filters. Sure. It's a little more lighting. Like, you saw it, it was in Side Effects a lot, where certain scenes, you know, just because he chose it or it was the lighting that was there, were, like, he would let them go very warm. And seemed like a very obvious thing. And he lets things go very cool. which is a little bit of like, I would say, a signature of this style and stuff that has been taken up, you know, outside of him a lot, where there's like a blue tone to a lot of it. And, you know, it's, it just, it has this like clinical feel.
And there, even though it's still, it's color, he has, I think, a high contrast in like the lighting gradients of his.
This one didn't have that like blown out daylight to me as much. And that may be because the camera's getting better. I don't know. But I didn't notice that as much in this one in Contagion. But it's still, it's certainly still part of it, I guess.
I have to assume that the digital filmmaking, I mean, has suited his. I don't think we get as many films from him in the last several years without the digital filmmaking world. I think he's like into having like maybe a seed of an idea, a pretty good idea. It might not be fully formed, but it's enough to go out and make the movie and make it quickly.
Yeah, I mean, Haywire and Contagion had that feel.
What do you think about like this, like for his stuff of, you know, the idea of, yeah, I have enough of a seed. Like, you know, if this is, I haven't heard him say this specifically, but I read into it as, you know, there's this huge gamble when you make a movie, even if you have a good script, of whether the movie's going to be good or not. And so he's just like, well, I like this enough to go make it. And yeah, maybe it's the one that's, you know,
the Woody Allen sort of
thing. Maybe it's Magic Mike, or maybe it's Haywire.
I definitely think that.
Like, I'm not going to know. And like, there's something that I would really respond to that of like, you know, he's not precious with these things. But do you, I don't know, do you buy into that from his experience? Or?
Well, I buy into that as part of the creative process. Like, you follow an instinct. I mean, this applies to anything. You know, it's like you follow an instinct, you follow an idea, and you see where it leads. And if you're a filmmaker, you're making a film. You know what I mean? Like, you don't, I mean, you can't reverse engineer it after, you know, you can't know that it's going to all come together and be a perfect success.
But then you look at, you know, our last podcast was Django,
right?
And Tarantino has a much different philosophy. He puts a lot of years and time into the one idea of, you know, eventually maybe he's got multiple ideas that we don't hear about, but he winnows it into this one script that is going to be his statement for those years.
And Paul Thomas Anderson, the same.
But Paul,
talking about track record. Yeah. Tarantino, you could say, has maybe one small blip on the track record, both from like a commercial success and like, you know, let's not get into the critical, right, did you like him or not, but no.
Well,
or is he just such an outlier? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. Yeah, I mean, his sensibility just ties in with commercial tastes a little bit better. I mean, it could be as simple as that.
I do think,
yeah, Soderbergh's tastes definitely don't seem to align.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see this guy. Like, it's so hard to get a beat, you know, not that we should be able to know who the guy is just from the movies and stuff, but it's hard to get a beat on, like, you know, what this guy might enjoy in his private life, you know?
Yeah.
The kind of movies and stuff.
He's a voracious reader and film watcher, though, right? You guys saw that list of what watches and reads and stuff?
I definitely, it just popped in my head. Side Effects reminds me of, like, sort of these 70s thrillers. Not the quintessential 70s movies that people think about, but sort of the, like, Clute and,
Well, he would probably like that comparison a lot, because I think he's, you know, he maybe, maybe I've even seen him talk about how much he's liked Clute, or, you know, like, there may have been that New York Times series where they would sit down with like a famous filmmaker and watch a movie. He may have chosen Clute. I'm not positive. Is it Sidney Lumet, or is it?
I think it's Alan Palooka, but
I'm not sure, actually, because Clute is, I don't think it's Lamette, though. I don't know.
But it has,
it feels like it's one of those guys.
Yeah.
It has a definitive visual style, but it's not by some, you know, directing auteur personality of a Coppola or Scorsese. With Side Effects, I don't even, like, they are not advertising this movie as a Soderbergh movie.
Well, I don't know that he has that name. I mean, maybe they would say from the director of his movies. I don't know if they would say Soderbergh, you know.
It's weird, though, because he has made a lot of movies recently. So obviously his name has, you know, and it's not like these movies are
but you look
easy
at,
movies.
He attaches himself to a certain pedigree of actor and stuff also.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's,
you know.
True, but what Side Effects, why are they making that movie, for instance? I was trying to
right.
think about this yesterday, actually. It's not like Jude Law is like some big star that, you know, everyone's like, ah, oh, we want Jude Law and whatever.
Yeah, we talked about this briefly after seeing it. Yeah, let's get into Side Effects a little bit. This felt like a movie that was, you know, late 80s or 90s Michael Douglas type of movie, like Disclosure and Fatal Attraction and
Falling Down.
I can see like a little bit of a comparison,
now.
But it is, I guess my one thing I would say coming out of the movie is it doesn't feel like a movie. Like those feel like a typical movie going experience. Like this to me,
here,
I have a tough time seeing
that's
like
why,
this
that's
was a movie.
Well, here's a huge difference. I mean, the first act is Rooney Mara's movie, where Jude Law is like a very small part of it, and then all of a sudden he takes over the movie for the rest of the movie, and then it's his movie,
right.
And
it becomes
and that would not happen
a thriller,
in, you know,
right?
Like Douglas movie, yeah.
It becomes a thriller pretty late, and for
well,
a while,
about
like
in
a
the middle, about the middle,
it's a social issue. Almost like it was funny because yeah, Greg and I saw Repulsion a couple weeks ago, and it. It had like a very, a very tangential,
yeah.
like, you know, second cousin thread to like, you know, women dealing with
crazy
insanity,
women.
Like for the first 30 minutes that, yeah, it's a totally different kind of movie.
Yep. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I never felt it totally found its feet after that in the thriller aspect, but I will say it was interesting to see what was going to, like, how it was going to try to resolve itself. And I wasn't engaged on, like, a narrative emotional level. I was,
it
was a higher level to me.
Yeah.
I mean, not higher. I shouldn't say higher as in better. I should say just, like, a different plane of.
Like seeing the puzzle come together kind of thing?
But not from a narrative perspective. It was a step removed of, you know, what are the filmmakers
how's he gonna
thinking?
Dance? How,
what are
how
they
is,
doing?
How are they going to dance out of this situation?
Yeah, how are they going to keep me interested for the next 20 minutes? I don't get it, you know.
Oh, what point did that occur to you?
Certainly, I would say halfway-ish when we never really brought it up. I mean, you know, there's obviously we're going to talk. This is a little bit of a twisty movie, and we're gonna spoiler alert.
Yeah, okay,
we're gonna blow through it.
Yeah, we're gonna. It,
and it's
so
a movie that
turn off right now. If you really are gonna see the movie, we're gonna give away some plot details.
You can't talk about the movie without giving away plot details.
So let's just go right. You know, I'm gonna jump right into it with when you start to suspect that Rooney Mara has ulterior motives. Like that, you know, she's almost like been play acting this thing, which I would say is halfway ish through the movie, you know, when Jude Law things turn on him, and I didn't go with it, and so I was kind of like, you know, and then the lesbian thing comes up.
You didn't go with the?
No, I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, I was like,
well, then you couldn't have enjoyed the movie then. I mean, because
I don't think the movie was great. You know, I was interested in interested, like, and I would say I'm not like a social issues movie fan.
So you didn't even like
I was kind of into the first half hour, 45 minutes of that world. Like, I thought it was pretty interesting. It was a really kind of fresh, interesting take on, you know, what, like, these drugs are in our society. I was kind of engaged on that level. And then when it became just, you know, a thriller or a lesser version of Primal, you know, Fear that Edward Norton, you know.
Yeah,
Brad brought that up.
Like, yeah, no, I mean, well, I brought it up
for a different reason, yeah. But it's well, that's because I was really engaged in it as like this sort of exploration into the pharmaceutical world and responsibility and psychiatry, and I was really engaged in it too for the duration of that, and I thought. I went into the movie without any preconceived notions or ideas what this movie was. Yeah. I don't even think I saw a full trailer.
I never saw a full trailer for it.
I knew there was
a thriller, you know, so I was sort of expecting some twisty stuff, you know, but I kind of wish I hadn't known that. But anyways, I feel like I jumped on it.
I didn't even know Jude Law was the main character. I heard Rooney Mara, right. And I'm like, ooh, I'm going to see this. And I didn't know anything. And then Jude Law's name is first in the credits. And I'm like, okay, he's in it and he's bigger than Rooney Mara.
Right.
And I'm watching it. And I'd heard Prescription Drugs and Rooney Mara. So that's where I'm coming from. And the movie starts off and it's these drugs and how they're affecting her. And the style is... very sophisticated and very classy at creating sort of this haze to try and capture her mind, her state of mind. And then she commits a crime. She murders her husband, and the movie becomes – the question of the movie is she responsible or not,
right,
for this crime? Or is the doctor who prescribed the drugs, or is the drug itself and leading back to pharmaceutical? And that is – greater than a half of the movie.
Right.
It becomes a thriller, and I almost feel like Soderbergh is deliberately taking on that challenge to make it a thriller that late. But it could have gone in like a lot of directions, and I was going to go with it. And I think it's like a testament to like how skillful the movie is done.
You like the thriller... You know,
I didn't dislike it, but I would have been as equally interested to see what their take on on it is.
I'm kind of curious. Deliberately trying to make it a thrill. Because you could also look at it as like, oh, he kind of doesn't know what he's doing. Right. And so it's like this kind of like flailing. I mean, yeah, I'm just saying, I don't know what the right answer is, but I'm just saying it's like, I mean, maybe they don't even know. Maybe they're like, you know, the filmmakers, I'm saying.
It becomes a different, and we brought up this labyrinth of plot line pretty late in the movie. And it becomes this salacious thriller, which I definitely liked as sort of like a pulpy thing, but I was also interested in it.
Yeah,
sort of kept on its own.
I mean,
it's a little impossible.
I'm thinking about all the turns. I mean, there's so many in the last 10 minutes of like even just Rooney Mara, you know, going to Jude Law's office for the last time, but then it turns out the cops are outside. But not only are the cops outside, there's like a fleet of cops there to arrest her, and it was just like, it just kept adding these.
That,
you know,
that didn't really. Yeah, I mean, so there. Yeah, it definitely had some issues of like making sense issues. I mean, I never thought that the bad guy plot was. It was both. A lot of these movies have these.
She's a genius villain, and Rooney Mara is a genius villain.
A lot of these movies
was beyond.
They
genius.
Suffer from these things where they're like, it's so ingenious. And then so stupid at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
Wait a second.
The lesbian thirst overpowers the genius, Greg. You don't understand.
But it's like so genius for these steps. And then this one simple step at the end, they can't even trust each other. And then they're able to get themselves manipulated. I mean, it has a quality of the Batman movies. The Batman movies have a lot of that same kind of quality where it's like the bad guys have these like incredible plans.
Yeah,
and yet they
down
make,
the like,
and then they make
years before they come out with this scheme.
I know.
If Marie Cotillard becomes this businesswoman and implants herself in the business community, then 25 years later
finally they're gonna do it, and then
Right.
They get foiled by Batman, who is just riding around on a
bike. It's a testament to the skill of Soderbergh, though, that it didn't run off the rails. Because I could see this completely, not like, looking back,
yeah.
being ridiculous where I want to walk out of
it
the theater.
It was ridiculous, but it was a tolerable yes. ridiculousness. And so I was okay with it. And, like, I enjoyed the movie more than I thought going in, because I didn't think it was... For some reason, I was like, because of Haywire. Because I got excited about Haywire. I don't know why.
Yeah, I didn't get excited. I guess I liked Magic Mike so much, and this was such an obvious, like, return. Like, I wasn't a big fan of Contagion. It felt like such
you didn't like Contagion.
No, not a lot. And yeah. it felt like a really obvious of that world to me. You know, it's mm-hmm. the same writer. And so I wasn't that excited about this one, but... You know, I was surprised that I did, you know, buy into, you know, kind of the first hour or so. And yeah, I do think, like what you were saying, that it's got a really interesting, like it made me, you know, it certainly made me think a lot about that weird relationship between doctors and pharmaceutical companies and all these drugs. And they're so common. Like some of the scenes I liked a lot, I love. Like the nonchalance of her boss talking about these different drugs that she's taking with her, and just this, like, you know, how it is such a part of, you know, the fabric of yeah. society now. It's yeah.
No, I agree. I like that aspect of the movie. I'm actually glad the movie became this, like, sort of contained
right.
thriller as opposed to where it could have gone.
Yeah,
which
I don't know
is
if
like,
it would have been good.
Yeah, I mean, like, what? Oh, it's the drug.
Yeah.
You know,
he,
sort of,
he does, like, oh,
the Aaron Brockovich.
You know? Or something. I don't
yeah,
know where
or, like,
it
somebody,
gone,
somebody, or, you know, you go up the chain and there's,
right.
you know, some bad people who are suppressing, you know, weird tests on this drug. You know what
right.
I mean? Because where else,
no, I
the movie,
I
where else could that movie have gone? Right. I mean, it did sort of get itself trapped into, okay, is this going to be a corporate conspiracy?
Right.
I don't know what else it could have been. You know, it's kind of social.
It's just this Catherine Zeta-Jones writing the article about the sleepwalking. I mean, it's just such ingenious, you know, work by these, yeah,
it's
diabolical
like, yeah, it's
villains.
It's like, you're so
I mean,
smart. Just go open a business. It's easier than plotting for 5 years and murdering people. That was the other thing. Is like the premise, this idea that she would murder this guy. I didn't believe. I was
yeah,
like,
by that
what?
She would actually kill.
Yeah,
this
I'm
guy.
Like, it takes.
I mean,
to
it means
someone?
Yeah,
like,
she's like psychopathic. Because it's completely then premeditated, and
it's
she
so
has to
premeditated,
put on
and it's
this
weird.
Whole act.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Well, yeah, the little flashbacks of showing her, you know, what? Putting on the act, and
yeah.
then you realize, yeah, that it, you know, she had to put on this act for 3 years, essentially.
Yeah,
but that's why it twists into this thriller, because they could have played it straight, where maybe she was under this. Haze of the drug, that's a different
yeah
he could have gone and they it becomes a thriller I think in the last act. I don't even think it's halfway through the movie.
No, but there's a mystery aspect where whenever
right.
Jude
yeah.
Law figures
but the mystery,
out whenever he figures out wait a second because well, that happens
there,
more
there's a lot of narrative going on, but yeah he's under attack, but that still doesn't make it the thriller the way they twisted into the thriller. Like he can be under attack he's under
no,
attack,
when,
and it's just the way they're approaching
the
material. The
minute he realizes that she might be guilty of something and starts investigating, to me, that's when it signaled it turning into the thriller. In fact, I think the last act was more about Jude Law plotting his how he was going to get back.
Right.
You know,
well, the thriller aspect probably takes on more when you know for a fact that. Catherine Zeta-Jones and Rooney Mara are in cahoots. Because that almost dates back to, like, we brought up this too for Basic Instinct
mm-hmm.
of where Sharon Stone is in, like, cahoots with his girlfriend slash psychiatrist, and you don't know, it's left open ended for a good part of the movie of who's on whose side and stuff. So yeah, it does have a little bit of that, but I think that's pretty late.
I think it has a lot of trademarks of thriller pretty early on. Like certainly when she kills the guy, it's.
I was really shocked.
Oh no, I was not. Well, I was when they were doing the knife cutting. Yeah, I was cringing when he walks in and he's was the scariest part. I was like, oh, I don't want to, because I felt something bad was happening. The knife chopping and not showing her face, and she was just like, I was like, oh God, come on.
But I think when they introduced that element and with the very intro of showing 3 months earlier. You know, the murder, the very first thing you see, I do think, I mean, maybe I knew it was a thriller to begin with, but it had, you know, versus a social justice movie or something, it had more trademarks music and style-wise of a thriller to me, where you just felt like, things are going to continue to go badly, you know, especially as Jude Law... you know, takes on the other pharmaceutical stuff and it becomes kind of his movie. You could just tell this guy's sort of at a high point and the movie's going to take him for a beating.
These kind of movies are so funny because I kind of admire these kind of movies, you know, these twists and turns.
When you say these, what movies are you thinking of beyond this?
I guess any sort of mystery... any sort of mystery thriller, I guess. And I feel like maybe we don't see them that frequently now.
Yeah, they've dropped off, like, you know, certainly. I mean, we were just talking about...
I mean, even
the,
Basic
Instinct.
We were
talking about the, you know...
Because Michael Clayton was so highly esteemed. I put this in the same category as Michael Clayton.
Well, it would...
Well, it would be...
Michael Clayton's
be
a little
if,
different.
It would be if it stuck to the social issue corporate... Like,
I thought Michael Clayton, though, sort of veered a little bit more into sort of like, I don't know.
Well,
I want to say a little
character study.
I sort of want to
title the movie.
Yeah. And this, like, I wouldn't say Basic Instinct is a character study, or like Wild Things, even, you know, like those kind of, you know, the sort of like, those are like in the sex thriller genre, but like, oh, God, I don't know. But, yeah, I guess I associate
these kind
of... Well, it's a
little, you know, do you think about Hitchcock at all when you think about these movies?
I don't, but I guess I possibly should. Because, yeah, I mean, a lot of Hitchcock movies... Hitchcock is sort of, like, lays the groundwork for these kind of movies.
Right.
But I think of these movies... I mean, Primal Fear is a good one.
Yeah, it does feel like there was this golden era, so to speak, like with Basic in the 90s, like maybe even early 80s, like Fatal Attraction, like on through Basic Instinct and Primal Fear, and like where there was this adult, like these were, you know, R-rated men, you know, bearded adults, and they were thrillers, like, you know, usually with a bit of like sex in it.
I did mention that. I didn't even know this was R. I get to the theater, I'm like, ooh, R-rated. Good sign.
I mean, Sidney Lumet, a lot of his movies actually kind of feel like that, like Q&A or...
Q&A is a good one.
You know, like where there's like sort of this like mysterious... I mean, and there's other ones. There's also like...
It's like a sleazy world. Like
Presumed Innocent is a different one.
Well, there was even that one. What was the one? Fractured, the Ryan Gosling, Anthony Hopkins one.
I didn't see that.
It was in this world.
Yeah. Where, you know, you aren't always sure where people...
Right.
But for some reason, like, some of them work. I mean, when they work, they're great, you know? But this one has a lot of...
Shattered with Tom Berenger.
some of the problems, like, some of the sort of, like, where they force the characters to do weird things that don't make sense. Like, for instance, when his wife, the Vanessa Shaw character, gets the pictures, you know?
Yeah.
And like runs out on him or whatever. It's like, isn't she like, why the fuck did someone taking pictures of you? I mean, why would anyone be taking pictures of him? It makes no sense. Like, if like I'm just thinking about
this stuff.
My relationship, though, like your relationship with people, like you just be like to your wife, you'd just be like, yeah, I don't know. That's a patient. I met her there. I mean, in real life, that wouldn't actually be an issue between two people. Right?
That's
part, do you know what I mean?
I think that's what attracted Soderbergh to this movie was the pharmaceutical aspect of it, but also that it's what connects it to his other movies recently to me is that I think he sees like this coldness going on. And that's what is so, I think, for me, compelling in this movie, and now looking back on The Informant and then Contagion, is that they're all painting a picture of, modern society where he feels there's something very cold and cynical going on between the layers of society, and it's how it's affecting people's relationships.
That's an interesting that's interpretation. However, I would say that the example that I just gave was more just of a sort of lazy, convenient plotting element. I know what you're trying to say, but I could see sort of an intellectual argument for that, but it was they were trying to push Jude Law out of, you know, take away everything from this guy and he's got to reclaim it, that kind of thing. I mean,
relationships between Rooney Mara and Catherine Zeta-Jones is every relationship in this
is untrustworthy. It's like noir, right? It's like, you can't trust anyone, that kind of thing.
And then I go back to The Informant. And where it's a guy who's a complete liar, and you know that deals with what is he's in the business world, and completely lying and getting through. And even though that's treated as sort of like this, satire.
Yeah.
So he's taking on the genre of satire there.
See,
and doing his theme through that movie. Here he's doing the thriller and putting his.
Well, no, certainly in the girlfriend experience, tie this thematic of, this cold, fake relationships that this woman provides, you know, this prostitute essentially provides these men and, you know, the trouble she emotionally gets into it, both with like her own, sustaining her own relationship and then falling for one of the guys. I mean, you know, I found that movie kind of interesting, whereas not, was a little bit similar to this movie, where it's kind of, that one felt more experimental than this one, but yeah, I know that I do agree that there is something common to like these scripts. I mean, obviously he's not writing these scripts that are coming to him that he's interested in.
Yeah, and then Magic Mike too, which seems on the surface so much, it's so much fun for the first half, and then has this dark underbelly behind it.
I would venture to say, though, that even though Soderbergh doesn't write these movies, don't you get the impression that he talks with the writers a lot when
they're working out?
I don't think it's like this guy writes something and then Soderbergh gets the script and he's like, oh, I want to make this. I feel like they're talking about the idea.
Yeah.
They're talking about movies.
Well, Magic Mike, no, but... maybe the others. I mean, because Scott, this guy who wrote Side Effects and Contagion, you know, Scott Burns, he's worked with for a long time. And same, I think Bubble and The Girlfriend Experience maybe is the same writer. I'm not positive. A woman, and I don't know who wrote Haywire, but yeah. So I mean, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, that's my impression, but I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I guess. I mean.
Just to like veer off when Side Effects. Yeah, what do you think about his interest in Channing Tatum? Like, it's such a kind of unusual actor to me. Like, he was so great in Magic Mike, but then
he was very much like sort of the engineer
that was his
of
world,
that
and he knew the
project,
world so well.
Yeah.
But then you look at Haywire and Side Effects, and the guy. Of a sore thumb to me.
I forgot
but
he's
Haywire,
in Haywire.
He's
in
a
it's
one
so
scene.
Short.
He's in
and I
scene.
Almost feel he's in this.
He's in two or three scenes.
He's in this long enough where I feel like that Soderbergh and him are friendly now, and he can pull this off without ruining the movie.
It's DiCaprio. Scorsese.
Danny Tatum is not DiCaprio. Yeah.
No, and but never will be. It's that relationship.
It's not that relationship.
Wait a second. Are thinking of DiCaprio now. You are not thinking of DiCaprio got cast in Gangs of New York. You're looking back. DiCaprio made himself into who he is now. He wasn't always guy.
But Greg, you could look at DiCaprio's like early few roles and say there was a lot more going on for him as an actor than Channing Tatum.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, feels he got a little for who's
like he's
eating
fair enough. Break. Like I don't see Channing Tatum suddenly being able to pull off a crazy Quentin Tarantino role.
No. You guys are right on that.
To like hang your hat on for a few movies, and I guess he hasn't hung his hat, but you know he certainly like I'm interested like why like it makes me interested in Soderbergh that he's interested in this guy.
It's not Soderbergh. It's Channing Tatum. This guy is reaching out and he played that bit part in Public Enemies.
I don't remember that, but...
He played Pretty Boy Floyd at the beginning of Public Enemies.
I almost had to ask, what movie? It's a Michael Bay movie.
He's doing these comedy things in addition to... I mean, he's famous for The Notebook, right? And then he does 21 Jump Street.
I believe The Notebook is Ryan Gosling.
Huh?
I believe The Notebook is Ryan Gosling.
What is Channing Tatum famous for?
Isn't he famous for a love movie
or something?
Maybe... I don't even think it's Dear John. That's the one.
Dear John.
Is it Dear John?
I think. Okay. I think this guy is reaching out and trying to be like, I want to work with these great filmmakers, and I'm going to try to use some celebrity to get in with them.
You're talking as if the guy is Colin Farrell. Like how Colin Farrell, within several years, was working with the most elite directors. I don't think that's this thing. I think just Soderbergh and Channing Tatum.
They get along.
They have like a friendship, and Soderbergh has.
So you're
going to
make a movie and you're going to cast me and Andy in it because we're friends?
If it's not a detriment to the film,
he likes you as like something that your personality brings to the movie. I mean, I would just say from, you know, it's like an outside perspective. You look at that pairing of Channing Tatum and Rooney Mara is, you know, it feels like an odd coupling to like base the first 30 minutes of the movie on.
What was that? Woody Allen, every actor in the world wants to work with Woody Allen. And for years, Woody Allen kept casting this redhead. His name escapes me right now, but he was in Beautiful
Which
Girls.
Which movie?
Michael Rapaport.
And these world-class actors couldn't believe that Woody Allen, movie after movie, would be casting Michael Rapaport.
Tell me a role of Michael Rapaport in a Woody Allen movie. I can't picture one.
Oh.
It never struck me that people were getting jealous of him.
Because he was filling up a role always. I mean,
was
he never a
Tom Crooks?
Like that era of Curse of the Jade Scorpion. And Michael Rapaport was in like four straight movies.
Really, yeah.
And I think it was just...
Well, Spike Lee, wasn't he in a bunch of Spike Lee movies too? Or maybe just one?
I always just think of him from
Beautiful Girls. He was in Bamboozled. Yeah. He was good in Beautiful Girls.
Michael Rapaport is Channing Tatum right now to me. I think the two get along.
Well, here's the difference is that to me, Channing Tatum is in a great movie. It held a great movie together. And Michael Rapaport has never done that. I mean, Magic Mike is going to, you know, you can come back to that and say Channing Tatum can act, and maybe it's because he's playing himself to a degree. Like, that's what we'll find out. But
here's what I would say, though, is that what I guess the only difference is my impression of Channing Tatum is that he is trying very hard to put himself in what quote unquote serious movies.
But what else besides Soderbergh? You know, can you think of another movie?
Well, Public Enemies. That's what I was saying. Is like he's trying. He's.
I guess I need another one. What's another one? I mean, that
well,
went
I would say I would say 21 Jump Street, not a serious movie, but trying something different.
Yeah,
trying to throw on comedic chops. So those are the movie. Those are the only movies that I. What other movies has he done in the last?
I don't know.
Couple years. Like,
I mean, he's done a couple. I think he has done one or two of those.
Oh, I know what he is famous for. He's famous for those Step Up movies.
Oh, that's right.
He's like a dancer and stuff.
He was in the at least the first
like
one
teenage,
for sure.
Yeah, like those teenage dance movies.
I totally forgot about that, and I've totally forgotten about that. And what an obvious relation that is to Magic Mike.
Yeah,
and my enjoyment of Magic Mike, that like the dance sequences are so much fun.
Yeah,
and like physical and
You guys are still on Channing Tatum.
Phil, we wanted to hear your take on his physicality in Magic Mike. No, let's move on to Rooney Mara.
Yeah,
she's good. I liked her better in this than Dragon Tattoo.
I like Rooney Mara.
I never
saw
the Dragon Tattoo. Her Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, that's surprising.
Well, I think it's.
Well, then what have you seen her in?
I was tired of the.
She's in a basketball movie.
That's what I was going to bring up. The Winning Season.
Yeah.
Her and Emma Roberts, really good in it.
And she's small.
Sam Rockwell.
Yeah. Sam Rockwell is the coach. He's sort of like
a high school kid, kind of
a degenerate coach.
Movie. Really like fun. Like
Sam Rockwell's good.
Like kind of like just nice. It's a nice movie.
And he's playing like a sleaze coach who gets one more shot at teaching. Girls basketball in high school, and he has one scene with her where she's making out with this older sleaze bag in a shoe store, and he comes in as like the father figure and takes her away, and then they have like this kind of twisted sexual chemistry that he has to like push aside. But I do remember her in that. But
I think she's been. I feel like maybe I saw her in one other movie besides, you know, the Facebook movie. And
is her sister
Kate Mara?
Kate Mara,
yeah. House of Cards.
Yeah, she's in House of Cards, and also I when I was watching House of Cards,
a couple things.
I was like, who is this girl? What do I recognize her from? She's the daughter in Brokeback Mountain,
right?
That
Kate Mara.
Small role that really stands out though. She's like a very.
No, I've noticed her before in a couple things, and I mean, I think I had just gotten tired of the Dragon Tattoo because I'd read the book and then seen the adaptation. I mean, the Swedish or Danish adaptation.
Yeah.
I can't even tell you what Scandinavian country it was, but that I wasn't, you know, even though it's so crazy to me when I say, oh yeah, David Fincher made that. I didn't watch it, but I don't know.
Yeah. I'm surprised you didn't see that, but I do think Rooney Mara, there's a lot of young actresses right now. I do think, She's at the top of them. Because there's shots in there, and probably the shot that I'll remember the longest in Side Effects is it pretty late in the movie, and they're revealing sort of Rooney Mara's like sexual relationship with
on the couch.
With I don't remember if it's on the couch, but they make her up to be like a porcelain doll. Do you remember the shot I'm talking about? Like, it's sort of a Catherine Zeta-Jones point of view looking at her. And they've made her look like a porcelain doll.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Where she's seducing Catherine Zeta-Jones for the first time in a flashback.
I couldn't remember if it was the first time or not.
I
remember this image of her, and I'm like, ooh, they made her look like a doll. And it just, like, stuck with me.
Yeah. I'm not totally sold on her from this movie. I think, you know, and the obvious thing to me, and yeah, she may prove it wrong, because I did like her in The Winning Season. I think it had a little bit more of this. It's just, like, I want to see the, like, how she performs when she has to smile, and, like, she's just, these roles she's played are so hard, you know, between this and, you know, I feel like I've seen the Dragon Tattoo because of, you know, the bombardment of trailers and her image in it. And, you know, that character's obviously so hard.
She didn't stand out to me in Dragon Tattoo at all. In fact, if anything, the first Dragon Tattoo girl in the Swedish versions stood out, I thought, more.
Who's that? Nomi Rapace?
Yeah. But I did think I was pretty engaged with her in the first act of this movie. But I guess What you could say is that, yeah, she doesn't.
Well, I was engaged.
What, you played depressed? She played depressed. She just played depressed.
I'm not
going right.
to suddenly put her in, you know, a category of young actresses that are like, oh, I'm really, you know, that could jump into any kind of role. I don't know. I mean, I'll be interested in what she does next.
Yeah, it'll be
she is an actress that if she is in a movie, I'll perk up and be wanting to see her performance.
Yeah.
More than, like, Amanda Seyfried gets a lot of talk right now. I've seen Les Miserables recently.
Right. Not Amanda Seyfried wouldn't be the right one. It would be Anne Hathaway. Would you compare her to, like is she going to get those? Is she going to go up against Anne Hathaway
that
for those
roles?
I
can see that. They're just
different. Well, I'm not saying they're similar, but I'm saying they're the same age and, like.
Oh, they are?
You know,
for some reason, I feel Anne picture Anne Hathaway is older, like much
I guess
older.
She's older, but I don't know.
I don't know.
I guess Anne Hathaway's maybe 30, and these girls are in their 20s. But I don't know. Maybe Emma Stone is like a more interesting counterexample of like what their career trajectories will be. You know,
I don't know. Yeah, just I don't know. I don't compare those people for some reason because it's kind of
I wasn't comparing. I was just saying like Anne Hathaway's gotten a lot of acclaim Les Mis.
Like,
I was saying like
Anne Hathaway is one of these like she's kind of like she has the whole singing thing too, but even separate from that she's like the every girl. She's like the Julia Roberts, the Meg Ryan kind of like girl, and then with Rooney Mara you think of like the girl with pathos and you know whatever like dark
Rightness
and like, you know, who was the other person that you said?
Emma Stone.
Emma Stone is like a comedian first to me,
right? But that's what I'm saying. You know, is those girls, I guess, or those actresses have shown a little more range to me than I mean, Rooney Mara hasn't been in that many movies.
She just
to show the range.
Much.
So I mean, I'll be interested to see if she can show anything towards range.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Can she play the manic pixie?
I was certainly like interested. Yeah, I would agree. Like the first half hour, I was into, and a lot of it.
Could she be Zooey Deschanel?
No.
No, but I mean, like that's like kind of to me what like okay,
right.
Like could she do the happy thing?
Right. Yeah.
Could she do that?
Could she do a version to me? I guess that maybe it's just partly saying the kinds of movies I like or.
Because, yeah. I mean, could Zooey Deschanel do this role?
No.
I mean, it's sort of like...
Right.
No.
I mean, that's...
I don't
know. So it's different. But that's what I'm getting at is like, yeah, Zooey Deschanel can be a fun actress, but
right.
I'm not going to say she's, obviously her range isn't, you're not going to jump out as saying that as her first thing. And that's what I guess I'm just cautioning against saying like...
Oh, yeah.
Like, against suddenly giving her
the
bill.
It's the fallacy of giving of the role or the actor.
Yeah.
She
hasn't tried it yet, so right. We don't ascribe the.
I do know that Rooney Mara did not hurt the film, and I think strengthened the movie.
Oh yeah.
Being on in the movie, and it made me think of another young actress. I mean, we can switch gears here and talk about a few other movies that.
Part 2 of this podcast will be released separately.
Don't tell my sister about your most recent vision. Don't tell my family they're a wicked, strict Christian. Don't tell the hangers-on. Don't tell your friends. Don't tell them we went down to Ybor City again. Don't tell the dancers, they'll just get distracted.